Log Talk Radio. Log Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship, locally and internationally, to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune in to 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
Welcome and hello, this is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. The unknown universe is the spiritual universe. Most folks out there are not in the rooms of recovery. If people, this is for people who want it, not just people who need it. If all the people who needed it got into the rooms of recovery, there'd be standing room only. But this, it doesn't work that way. So this is an informational program to tell you what it's like, what happened, and what it's like now. So this will give you an idea of what we do in recovery. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audiences in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. They believe in the work that we're doing, getting the message out. That's what we do. We're getting the message out. We also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. I'd gratefully like to introduce my co-host, Harold B. Harold's a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I personally believe that families are the basic unit of our society, and as the family goes, so does the nation, and so does the world. I believe today that the families are being beset on all sides, spiritually, financially, morally. The fabric of our nation is being torn. Children are not being taught correct principles at home. Most, if not all, of the drug and alcohol problems come from the breakdown of the family. You go into the prisons, the majority of the folks in the prisons are there because of drugs and alcohol-related incidents. There's very few career criminals. These are usually crimes of opportunity. It just sounded like a good idea at the time. Trish Murphy did a song, it's When You're Young and Dumb, The Trouble with Trouble is It Starts Out as Fun. And things sound like fun when you're on drugs and alcohol. Things that you normally would not have even considered all of a sudden sound like a lot of fun, or they're doable now. So this is our way of giving back, making this information available to people in recovery and the general public. And let me tell you, everybody knows somebody that has an addiction problem, a codependent problem, alcohol, pornography. It's just there. It's epidemic. Somebody knows somebody. Harold?
Yes. Hi, everybody. And thank you for that introduction, Joseph. It's my privilege to be here. This is one of the ways that I give back, and I owe everything to the program of recovery. I carry recovery lessons into the Fort Bend County Jail every Monday night at 6:15. Another way that I give back, And it's true. My first sponsor told me years ago, 25 years ago, that not every did I. He asked me if I noticed not every time I drank did I get in trouble, but every time I was in big trouble, there was alcohol or drugs involved, and I had to admit that was true. So that was the beginning of a better life for me. So working with others is really the key to this whole thing. It's fairly easy to quit. It's more difficult to stay stopped, and that's where working with other people really serves an important function. So Joseph has put together this website, and it's called rumradio.org, and the design is to make it easy to see all the benefits from working with other people, how to find someone to work with if you've been around a while, or if you're brand new. If you're brand new, you're the most important person in the room. So it's also important to work with someone else. Let me mention right quick that Joseph doesn't make a penny from this website or the radio program, Rum Radio. He does this as a public service, as his way of giving back, and he has sunk thousands into the website and the radio program, making improvements, and I appreciate his giving and his generosity that way. So we hope that this helps you a bit. So let's move right into the third step prayer part.
Sure, Harold. I like to start with the third step prayer. One thing, when there's a newcomer in the room of recovery, usually we'll tell them during our shares, it's usually directed towards the new person, that they're the most important person in the room, besides me, or unless the room catches on fire. That usually means that recovery is an individual process. We're glad they're there, and they are important to us because they're life's blood to AA, just like the old-timer is the backbone, but relapse is the soul, because there's nothing so tormented as a head full of AA and a belly full of booze. And that gives us a way of working with that new guy, and then he can go work with someone else, and that's the way it's supposed to work. And that's why he's important. He's the life's blood coming in there. But he has to work his own program. All a sponsor really does is get the person into a conscious contact with God. That's it. The steps, all the steps, bring you to that one conclusion, the one result of these steps. Is a connection with God. That's it. Okay, I'd like to start the program with the third step prayer. When I get a new sponsee, the big book tells us, go find a prospect and start working on them. I like that. It's a nice, simple instruction. So I go find my prospect, and what I do is I'll grab him by the hand after our prayer. We usually have a prayer in the beginning of the meeting, and there's a prayer at the end. It's called an invocation in the beginning, inviting in the spirit, and a benediction, thanking for the spirit to be with us. All topics in recovery, no matter what the topic's been, all the meetings are gratitude meetings. Because we're grateful, we're there, we're sober, and we're growing spiritually, hopefully. And after the prayer, I grab the new man by the hand, and it's, I believe, men with men and women with women. It's easier to relate to the same gender. And sponsorship is very intimate and could be easily misconstrued or misunderstood, and dire consequences from any romantic liaison that could develop. If you can't find same gender, the direction is you work the steps. So I grab him, I grab my man, and I ask him, have you had enough? If he's had enough, he'll know what I'm talking about. Or he might ask, have enough of what? Have you had enough humiliation? Have you had enough pain? Have you had enough alcohol? Have you had enough? Yes or no? Yes. If he says no, then you got nowhere to go with this guy. He's not ready yet. Or not ready for me. The next question, next statement is, are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? And essential question, yes. He's not telling me. He's also telling himself. And I said, okay, you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And the first thing I need you to do is answer these questions. I carry them with me when I'm looking for a sponsee. I believe luck is nothing more when preparation meets opportunity, so I'm prepared. I give them Clancy Eyes 7 questions. I have it on the website underneath the how to find a sponsee tab. Print them out. It's in Word. And I give them the questions. Okay, I need you to answer these 7 questions. They're very probing. Doesn't matter how he answers them. The fact is that you give them the questions. You tell them, okay, I need you to answer these questions, and I need them back tomorrow. Here's my number. Expect your call. I'm done for all intents and purposes. If he calls me, great. He's taken simple instruction, and he's demonstrated the fact that he's willing to go to any length. If he doesn't call, two things, he's either not ready or he's not ready for me, and I'm not a sponsor for everyone, although I do pretty well. I could do both the low bottom and the high bottom. I've done that. The 12 steps will work for anybody. But that sometimes personalities, whatever. So he's not ready. If he is ready, then I give him his first instruction, and that is to find a home group. A home group is your lifeline group. So this way, I want you to get 20 or 30 names, if possible, of men in your group. And I want you to ask, give him permission to take or get it from the chairperson if they don't have a newcomer's packet, but get the names and these people give the number with the agreement that they're available for telephone calls. And then I want you to call a different man every day for the next 30 days and recite the third step prayer. Found on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. By the way, this is not AA. We don't represent AA, NA, or CA. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. The only problem is nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. So, thank you, Harold. So, after that, I said, okay, call a new man every day. And the reason I do that is to get him used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Two, it connects him up in his home group. These are his lifeline folks. He might need these numbers down the road because the sponsor might not always be available. So he needs other people to talk to. Or something comes up. So now he's connecting. They get to know his name, and he gets to know their name, so they're making a connection. Third, it's encapsulating what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. I also call it the surrender prayer. And fourthly, the person he's calling might have been thinking about picking up his first drink of alcohol, first hit of crack, or first whatever, and chances are he will not. But your sponsee's already into service work and connecting up into the fellowship. I find this to be very productive in all areas. Not perfect, but it's productive. And this is the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
Thank you. Well, I'd like to introduce our interview for tonight. I'm kind of excited. Dr. Darlene Lancer. She's written a book, Codependency for Dummies. She's a writer, very articulate, very knowledgeable in codependency. I tell my sponsees, if you really want to be a good AA sponsor, go to Al-Anon. You're going to be dealing with a lot of drunks, and there's essential information. I'd also say, and a lot of folks don't like this, but Al-Anon is postgraduate AA. You're going to learn a lot in Al-Anon. This is really where the rubber meets the road. We've stopped drinking. The chances are you're not going to drink again. But interpersonal relationships, codependency, all of that is still out there in the jungle. And until you address this stuff, you might be happy, joyous, and free, but you're not going to be everything that you could be. So, Darlene, tell us what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now.
Thank you so much for inviting me to join your program. And just for your audience, I'm actually not a doctor, although I have a Juris Doctor degree because I used to be a lawyer. I'm a marriage and family therapist. And I started going to Al-Anon way over 30 years ago. And I guess I'll just start at the beginning, because I came from a family that from the outside looked like it was a healthy family, and in some respects it was. There was no physical abuse. There was no overt addiction. I think my dad was a workaholic, but there was no drug addiction to speak. And however, I had a narcissistic mother, and she was very critical of me, and critical in ways that were shaming, so that I didn't realize at the time, but I think as early as, you know, first grade, I remember being in the sandbox, actually. I was probably about 5 and a half, or just 6, something like that. And I was talking to a little girl that was 10, and I thought to myself, well, when I have 2 digits in my age, then I'll feel better. And I think what I meant was, I'll have more self-esteem. Of course, I didn't know those words at that time, but I would feel better about myself.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And I can't tell you that there was any precise incident or traumatic experience, but my mother wasn't a very nurturing person. She did all the right things in terms of trying to be a good mother. She herself never knew her father, and she later told me that her mother told her that she tried to abort her, which is a horrible thing to tell a child.
Oh.
Because probably my grandfather, that I never knew, probably abandoned her mother while she was pregnant. That's my guess. But my mother would never talk about it. And she told me her mother would always say, it's too painful, I don't want to talk about it. So she knew nothing of her father. And then not too long after she was born, she had an older sister that died. And then when she was about 8, she had a brother that died. So there was a lot of loss and abandonment. Her mother had to support these children, and she was working, and she never got much attention. So my mother went out of her way to, and her mother was an immigrant also, so there was a lot of that feeling of wanting to be assimilated and be accepted, being a minority. So that was a pressure too. I'm really focused on shame right now, because I'm writing a book about shame. And so I see how endemic it is, and I believe that it's the core of addiction and codependency. And I've written, and it's my belief that codependency underlies all addiction, whether or not you think of codependency itself as an addiction. But so there was shame was going on for her, you know, from the beginning, and then it gets handed down. And she tried very hard to be, she would say that she always had clothes that were too big that she would grow into, that she felt, I'm sure, ashamed of. And her mother didn't, you know, spoke broken English and all of these things. And so she tried to give to me all the things that she didn't have. She would try to give me a lot of attention. And she would always want to buy me nice clothes. But what was lost in all of this is that she really didn't see who I was. she was trying to make me into this, the child that, and give me the childhood that she never had. So I'm feeling actually surprised. I'm feeling a little emotional as I'm saying this. And so she really tried hard. And the point also is that someone who shame can get handed on unintentionally. Just if you have like if a parent is preoccupied with health or economic concerns, they're not giving their child enough attention and empathy. And in any event, so my mother was telling me, like, how to be a lady and, you know, how to act and how to behave. And I would say probably gradually by the time I was 3, I learned very well how to accommodate and be who she wanted me to be. And that's how I would, you know, get approval and love. And at the same time, she could be sarcastic and critical, all trying to be helpful and tell me, you know, criticizing me to correct me. But being overly criticized and overly controlled is lays the ground for codependency as well.
And I didn't know that.
Yes.
I have a granddaughter, Claire. My daughter, I've had 2 daughters die from the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction.
Oh,
and,
sorry.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. In a way, I hate to say it because I could hear the other people's pain with it. I'm very confident in the spiritual life, so I'm Rum Radio is part of that therapy for me to so I can be helpful to maximum service. I wasn't a really good dad, but I'm a really good grandpa. And my youngest daughter, Christina, when she died, Claire was only like 2.5 years old. So she had this tremendous sense of abandonment. And it was very deleterious for the very longest time. And I've done a lot of work with her, and she's really kind of blossoming now, where she's accepted all that. And, you know, so the father, you know, tries to keep me away at arm's length, but I've overcome him too. But I think work with another individual and build up their self-esteem and letting them know that this wasn't personal, that the drug addiction was not, you know, she tries to judge her mom, and I says, you know, honey, you don't need to do that. That's not going to help anybody do anything. It was by accident. This wasn't intentional. What do you think? Is that the right approach?
What do you mean? That was accident, that wasn't intentional?
Well, she was taking drugs and alcohol. She died. It wasn't suicide.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It wasn't, you know, like the child thinks that my mother abandoned me intentionally. So I tried to say, no, this was by accident. Is that the correct?
Well, of course.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, empathizing with her feelings, you know, whatever she's feeling. So one of the things that my mother tried to be helpful with was talking me out of my feelings.
Ah.
So what happens is, after all, you start to doubt yourself. Or I was punished for getting angry, for talking back, or for expressing anger. One time I was, my mother wasn't listening, and I wanted to show her something, and I got frustrated, and I stamped my foot, and I got punished for that and sent to my room. And I just thought that was so unfair, and that punishment kind of epitomized feeling that I had, that it of unfairness. And so often people who have had a controlling or narcissistic parent, there's a saying, it's my way or the highway.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to kind of go along with their agenda, or you get a rage, severe punishment, withdrawal of love, all sorts of you know, negative reactions that a child can't tolerate because, of course, they want and need that connection with the parent to survive. So I learned that I wasn't okay, you know, to get angry. And then, ironically, when later on in my teens, when I had, like, crushes or boyfriends that I was disappointed in, or I would be hurt and I would be crying, and then my mother say, "Why are you crying? You should be angry." So,
see, now you were kind of confused at what's the correct emotional response to this environment?
So that was kind of very confusing to me. So then gradually I learned to repress my hurt feelings as well. And I couldn't go to her with hurt feelings either, because she just wasn't that, as she would probably tell me, it was my fault, you know, and she wasn't really a warm, nurturing person. I remember in grammar school, I used to wish that my mother baked cookies, like some of the other. Now, this is a long time ago when my mother always worked, but at that time there were a lot of stay-at-home mothers, more so than today. Mm-hmm. And some of my girlfriend's mothers were brownie leaders or baked cookies and things like that. I'd go after school to their home. And I think in retrospect that baking cookies symbolized nurturing to me. It's like the food of a good mother. And that's what I was, I didn't know, you know, the word nurturing or empathy or anything like that. So baking cookies was my idea of love. Fortunately for me, I had a very loving father. And I always felt like I could be myself and that I was loved by my father unconditionally. So I had another parent that I could feel good about. The only thing was that he didn't protect me from my mother's anger or my mother's unfair punishments. I mean, for instance, I remember my junior high school prom that I wanted to wear my hair in an updo, and my mom said, "No, wear it down." I had long hair. And so I went to a beauty shop, and I told them to fix it up, put it up. And I came home, and she was just so livid that she grounded me from all parties for a month. And so that was kind of the extreme. I wasn't beaten like some kids, but just this idea that it was her way or the highway. So
you missed your prom over that?
Well, I went to the prom, but there were a lot of parties that I didn't get to go to with my friends. So the prom was in the afternoon. I was just like 14 or something with junior high school. So this taught me to be compliant, basically. And then my dad didn't stick up for me, and I had two older brothers that were much older, 8 and 10 years older, that used to tease me. And people might think that it's harmless, but tickling till you can't breathe is abusive and things like that, or scaring me, teasing me with, you know, fear and things like that, or humiliating me in some way. And my parents really just thought it's like normal sibling rivalry. But I don't think, looking back, I don't think so. I think it was disempowering. And so I think I saw my father as very weak. And I made up my mind I wanted to marry a man that was strong. And I also had this fear that in my young, confused mind, that if a man were to please me and be nice to me, that was weak. And that my fear was that I would turn into my mother, who would criticize my father in front of me, which I found humiliating to him and made me angry at her and more sympathetic to him. and very angry at him that he wouldn't stand up to himself. And I would tell, I once said to him, and he'd say, well, he'd shrug his shoulders like, well, what can I do? You know how your mother is. So what happened was, I think my addiction would be called romance addiction. Because as a girl, I'm reading like Cinderella and all these stories, and I'm just thinking, you know, I'm just idealizing a prince and somebody who's going to rescue me. I used to always want to hear stories. My father would tell me bedtime stories, and I'd say, tell me the story about the bad girl that runs away. And she's like caught by the evil witch, and somehow the witch is dead and the girl is free. And, you know, I think I had all of these urges of rage inside of me towards my mother that I couldn't express. And this was the bad, you know, this is the bad seed, the bad part of me that was symbolized by these stories of the bad girl. And then, of course, the witch would be my mother. Or Cinderella, like I would think of the evil stepmother, or Snow White stories or things like that. So how could I possibly be a good person if I hated my mother? You know, how could I? What was wrong with me? There must be something. I'm really bad inside. I'm not, you know. And then she would say things like I'm selfish, or you know, things like that that would just reinforce that. And then of course you'd see television with all these happy families and people loving their parents and their mother, and so I just thought something was like endemically wrong with me. Seriously wrong. So I had, from a very early age, probably my brother was in medical school, and I was about 12, and I started reading some of his medical books, and particularly Freud's interpretation of dreams. And I was fascinated by it, and I was reading by flashlight at night in bed. You know, I wasn't supposed to be reading his books. And I thought, wow, if somebody could really figure out the meaning of dreams. I don't think I totally agreed with Freud, and I don't to this day. But so I thought, I want to be a psychiatrist when I grow up. And then as I got a little older, I started reading books by Jung, and I thought, oh, this is even better. I really like Jungian philosophy. And I think I told my mother that I wanted to be a psychiatrist. And she just dismissed that as like a stupid idea and that I wouldn't like it. And I overheard her telling my other brother that he would be a very good lawyer. And later on, I went to, when I was in college, and I found a letter home from my first year in college where I said, I'm going to think I'd be a psychologist or a writer. And then I transferred to UCLA from where I was. And by the way, I really wanted to go to Berkeley. All my friends were going to UC Berkeley. My brothers had gone there, and I had made up my mind, but my mom had other plans, and she sent me off to another school, and I didn't really have a choice in the matter. So that's another example. And anyhow, so I started dating somebody at UCLA who said, why don't you come to my law school class with me? I think you'll like it. So I went, and I liked it. It was like philosophy. And so I enrolled, and I was a war protester at the time and wanted a poli-sci major, and I thought I would, you know, that would be a good combination. I wanted to work for the State Department. So I thought, okay. And it wasn't till many years after practicing law for many, many years, I was an entertainment lawyer, that I was sitting in therapy one day, and I just, like a light went on. I thought, oh, my God, I just realized why I went to law school. And that was because my mother wanted my brother to be a lawyer.
Ah.
And growing up, when I would ask her things, she would say, well, ask your brothers, they're so smart. So she always looked, there was a lot of chauvinism in my family. And her sons, you know, the boys were considered very smart. And she said, you know, why don't you just get a teaching credential in case you ever get divorced and have to work? Or become a dental hygienist or something. So I think, and I was an 18.
How about a janitor? Can you handle janitor? Maybe you can handle janitor.
A wait, you know. So I think none of this was conscious. You know, I thought, well, I went because my guy was dating. It seemed like a good idea. That was all rationalization. The unconscious reason was that I would get the approval of my mother. And when I told her, well, there was one time when we were sitting in therapy together years later, and I said, you know, I figured out why I went to law school is because you wanted my brother to go. And she said, she nodded, and she said, yes, he would have been a great lawyer.
Oh, no.
She just, in the was a psychiatrist at the time, and he looked at me and rolled his eyes. She couldn't see. So, anyhow, I was good at practicing law, but I was unhappy for many years. And it was, again, like I didn't know myself. And even though I was unhappy doing it, I kept trying harder. So it was just more of like trying to be a square peg and fit into a round hole, like trying to get my mother's approval. It was more of the same. And I was in an unhappy marriage, and I kept working on that. And I found somebody that I could, that seemed to me that needed help. And I was going to help him and rescue him. I didn't think in those terms. I just thought, oh, he's so open and he's so emotional. And, you know, I didn't think of, see it as depression or things like that. And later, you know, I've discovered that he's very controlling, and much more so than even my mother. But it was just a repetition of an extension of the family that I had grown up in my relationship with my mother. And he was also verbally abusive. And so my little self-esteem I had coming into the marriage got lower and lower and lower. And I, now here's where what I told you earlier about repressing my anger and not being protected from either my mother's anger or my brother's teasing came into play, because I didn't know how to stand up for myself. And and so what I've learned now, and that's a mistake that a lot of people, particularly women, make, is that they try, when they're in an abusive relationship, they try to placate the abuser. Or placate the addict, for example, as opposed to setting boundaries. But there were no boundaries in my family, because my mother was telling me what to do, as I've related, and controlling and making decisions for me, telling me how to wear my hair, things like that. So those are all invasions of boundaries, and any kind of verbal or physical or sexual abuse are boundary invasions. So, however, when I met this man, I saw that I love the fact that after he knew my mother, he called her a bitch. Because I thought,
you were buds right off the start.
Huh?
You were buds right off the the top. Yes, you know, that's her. Yes, it is. That is my mother.
Yeah, I thought, well, but I thought this is somebody who'll, like, stand up for me and protect me. And I think that that was, you know, it was giving me, it was a way that I could leave home, basically. I graduated college very young. I was only, I was only 22 when I graduated law school. I was 19 when I graduated college. I was always, like, in a hurry.
Interesting.
Darlene, I'd like to regress a little bit about the boundaries. That's a big issue, especially with an alcoholic, because we completely ignore them. We can neither give them or take them. If you want to get an alcoholic that's still not in recovery, upset, you give him a boundary, and dollars to donuts, he will not accept that boundary. And not being able to accept it, cannot give it, have no idea what a boundary looks like. I heard, I told you I'm an Al-Anon, so I've gone to Al-Anon. I think it's a great way. I believe it to be a postgraduate AA, is Al-Anon, where you go and you continue to grow emotionally and spiritually by learning how to be interactive with other people, and that's usually most of the problem. I heard it spoken, it was like a traffic light, like a boundary, like a red light was a traffic light. And you didn't look at it that it stopped you, but the red light allowed you to go safely to your next destination.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I think 2 months ago I wrote an article on the power of boundaries on my blog. By the way, my website is whatiscodependency.com. There's another one, if you forget that, it's just my name, DarleneLancer.com. And I write a blog every month, and this one on power of boundaries goes into detail about it. And one of the things I say is that you can think of boundaries as your bottom line. They're like rules that you live by. And how much, what you will do, what you won't do, what you'll give, what you won't give. It's a little more subtle when it comes to emotional boundaries, because it's like it's not really tangible. It's more like taking responsibility for your needs and feelings and not taking responsibility for someone else's. And that gets really blurry with codependents, and they're highly reactive and feel guilty. They listen to somebody else's problem right away, think they have to fix it. They feel guilty. They're giving advice, which is, you know, crossing a boundary and things like that.
Isn't everyone codependent to some degree on something or someone?
Well, I would say a huge percentage of our population are. In my book, Codependency for Dummies, I cite some statistics. There's about 70% of people that are affected by alcohol. And in their a relative or family, and so they're likely codependent. And then I think there's another 20% that have mental illness in the family, and so that often there's codependence there. So it's very prevalent in the U.S. And what's amazing to me is that a lot of people who follow my page on Facebook from all over the world. A lot of people in the Middle East are waking up to this issue of codependency.
And really?
Yeah, they have rehabs in Pakistan and India, and people are trying to turn around, and it's, in a way, it's countercultural. So it's really hard, particularly for women that are an underclass in many of these countries. They don't have the rights they do here, that they're just really learning about codependency and trying to, it's really revolutionary, I think, which I think the 12 steps are revolutionary. But anyway, so where was I? So talking about.
You met your future codependent.
Oh, I always like to say he was, it was love at first blight. So he told me like this, like sob story of his life, and my heart went out to him, and like he seemed so open, and you know, I didn't, you know, today if I met somebody who in the first hour of meeting would start to tell me their life story and all these problems, I think I'd head for the hills. It's like no boundaries. You just don't divulge all that to somebody when you first meet them. But in any event, it was very romantic. And so I know. So I was saying, so I think I felt like he was going to help. I graduated very young. So even though I had finished my studies, I don't think I was emotionally prepared to go out and, you know, go work in Washington, D.C. or something like that that I had imagined at 22 years old. And I hadn't supported myself. And so I think at some unconscious level that he was going to help me become autonomous and also to stand up. Now I had an ally that I could set boundaries with my mother. And when I had our first child, which was very soon, she wanted to drop by whenever, and that was not okay. And she got so angry that I asked her to call first, said she stopped speaking to me.
Oh, so, man.
This was an example of, you know, her way or the highway. And she was making a scene in the hospital, you know, demanding to see her grandchild. I was hearing voices yelling. And so I had trouble, you know, dealing with it. And because of her abandonment issues, what would happen was whenever I would attempt to set a boundary, she would feel abandoned. So because of her childhood. And
yeah.
So then she would withdraw and feel very hurt and abandoned, and then would go into like a narcissistic rage and feel humiliated, and would stop speaking to me, and that happened a number of times. So this was an ongoing, you know, thread, but of course, marrying somebody who I thought I mistook his anger as strength. Of course, it wouldn't be long before it would be turned on me, and he would be calling me a bitch. So, and it took me, I eventually left that marriage, and it took me a long time, actually, to understand these immature beliefs that I had formed in my childhood, that someone who is nice to me does not mean that they're weak, and that I really deserve to be loved and to be treated well.
I've heard this, that anger could be as heady as whiskey once you've gotten a taste for it. So it sounds like he had a taste for it.
He did?
Yes.
Right. So he was dealing with his own demons, which I won't go into. But another dynamic I will share with you is that he would always want my advice, which was just, you know, to insecure codependent is like, you know, candy, you know. So I would give my advice. And then he would say, well, yes, but have you considered this? And so then I would say something else. And this could go on for like over an hour. Meanwhile, I had children that are, you know, dinner's ready. And I had just come from a long day of work in a law practice myself. And so eventually I would just say, you know, I don't know, or I get impatient, and then that would start, that would be fuel for like this game we were playing, like yes, but kick me, and which I didn't coin. It's a think Irene Casorla coined that one. So it was this routine that we would play, and it took, I wanted to avoid these conflicts, and so I tried not giving advice, and that was really, really hard for me. And I was on the phone with a sponsor all the time, and he would, like, follow me around and, you know, just say yes or no, or what's your gut feeling, things like that.
Well, when did you, I missed that, when did you get to Al-Anon? Had you been to Al-Anon yet, or you, could
well,
you mention
somewhere
sponsor?
Along the way, I had found my, I got to Al-Anon, and
did
so
you reach
I,
an emotional bottom? Usually an alcoholic is going to hit a bottom of some kind, where the pain and the anxiety is just more than he can bear. He doesn't know whether he can't drink and thinking
no,
of drink.
No, not might, at all. No. I went to help another alcoholic. I went to help an alcoholic. I didn't go for me.
Ah.
I went for somebody else. And I worked the steps, you know, thinking, you know, it will help the relationship. But I remember, I don't know if you know of Ernie Larson.
I've heard of him, yes. Yeah.
And he was wonderful, did a lot of wonderful writing and tapes and stuff for on codependency. And I would meet with a group of women in my home. We listened to his tapes, and he'd talk about taking the steps for the first, you know, working the steps for yourself. Because I was, like, working it for the alcoholic. I was working it for the relationship. And unlike, you know, it's like codependency or Al-Anon could be a little bit more subtle in a way, where if you're going because of a food addiction, a, you know, a drug or gambling addiction, you really know that it's you is the problem. And that's the issue. There's so much denial around codependency that, you know, you still think that it's somebody else. So I started working the steps all over again just on myself and regardless of whatever happened in the relationship. Because I was still trying to work the steps to make the relationship work as opposed to for just for me to get better. And anyway, so I eventually I took a class on assertiveness and I started standing up for myself. And I started setting boundaries. And don't talk to me that way. That's abusive. And my mother would say, oh, I have to watch everything I say about around you. And I think, great. I'm thinking to myself, great, you know. And people don't like it when I call it resetting boundaries. When you haven't had them and then suddenly you try to impose them, people usually don't like it.
Oh, yeah. And I used to that.
Yeah, and you're going to get a lot of pushback. But you just have to hang in there. And, you know, I work with people. I work with some people. Sometimes I don't see the couple. I'll just see maybe the person that's being abused, and they don't come as a couple. And over time, by working on their own self-esteem and becoming more assertive and learning, you know, how to value themselves and focus on themselves and not react and to detach and things like there's a lot of things involved. Amazingly, the abuse starts to stop. It's, you know, it got much, much less in my marriage, and it got, it just, things start, when you, one person changes, the whole dynamic changes.
Yeah. Was there a particular step that you started to see? Usually in AA, if we do it right away, step five usually is a critical step. It's the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. Did you find anything like that? You've already had God, right?
I should have mentioned I came to the program as an atheist.
Ah,
really
Harold did too.
Pardon?
Harold did too. Harold, you got a kindred spirit here.
Uh-huh.
That's right, and we're both family therapists.
Right. So I see, you know, I didn't trust my parents, And so how could I trust God, you know? And I trust, how could I trust anybody? And the way I learned in Sunday school, it was all so seemed, you know, imagine like God, like on a throne in the sky. It seemed like very juvenile to me, and just I couldn't accept anything like that. And when I first walked into the rooms and people were saying, well, God really helped me today. I found this parking space, and he saved my home from bank, you know, saved my home from foreclosure. And I'm thinking, these people are really nuts. What are they talking about? And so I had a sponsor that said to me, you know what, share it in a meeting. And I said, oh, I couldn't do that. She says, no, really, share it, talk about it. So I did, and I started saying that I got angry whenever I heard people talking about, you know, that. And so I started I read Scott Peck's book about the road less traveled, and I started looking for synchronicity. And I really started developing some faith. And then, I mean, I could talk for a whole hour on my relationship with God because it's gone through a lot of metamorphoses. A lot of it has, as my relationship with myself has changed, my relationship and my concept of God has changed tremendously. So I went from one extreme to the other extreme, you know, and then finding my way back to the middle or to my own definition or something that is comfortable for me in my life today. However, I do want to say to your listeners that I did a lot of, I've had many, many years of therapy in addition to my professional training. And I also spent a lot of time that was wasted in therapy. And I want to be able to say that the two things that I think are the most important in overcoming codependency is working on building your self-esteem. And I think there's definitely things I could share that help with that, and learning to be more assertive. Now, some people think that they're assertive, but they're really aggressive. So, like in my family, my father was passive and my mother was aggressive. So I never learned what it is to be assertive, which is being assertive. You don't have to alienate people. It's using I statements. I wrote a little ebook on assertiveness because I think it's so important. And then working on your self-esteem and issues of shame underneath to really feel worthy of self-respect and love. And my relationships after my divorce, where they each continue. I thought my self-esteem was really great at that point. I didn't realize it really wasn't. I think I was kind of on a high. And I would still, you know, I wasn't involved with someone who was abusive, but someone who might be withholding or just not really giving or loving in the way, treating me in the way that someone who is really cherished and loved should be treated. And it took a while to really, as I was mentioning about really feeling deserving of love and not thinking that someone pleasing me is weak or codependent necessarily, you know, that somebody could want to do that out of love and still be independent, strong person.
Let me digress a little bit. Where did you find God? Work in the steps? Is that it? Did you do step two, coming to the power, or was it a more gradual effect? Step five, step nine.
Well, I couldn't attribute to any particular step, but I would say it started with looking for synchronicity. Looking for synchronicity.
Yes.
And then, happened. And, you know, today, whether you call it as God or fate or, you know, it's like just kind of magical. I don't think that we know all the answers. But I wrote a book that I was hoping to publish that I wasn't able to get a publisher for. But in trying to build a presence on the internet, Wiley Publications found me and asked me to write Codependency for Dummies. I never planned, actually I didn't want to write a self-help book. I didn't want to be giving people advice or anything like that, but they asked me to do it, and I did, and now I'm writing a book on shame for Hazelton. So, what I wanted to say is, what's magical about it is I think it was fulfilling God's plan for me, because it was in 1995, a few months before my mother died, and I had a dream telling me that I would reclaim title to myself, and that I would share it with others. So I think that I would go into the forest, that I would write about it, my experiences, and I would reclaim title to myself. And I think that's what healing codependency is, who your true self is, not who I was, you know, trying to please somebody else or trying to win someone's love, and learning to really be my authentic self, and that that's okay. That, yes, I am a flawed human being, and just like the rest of humanity. And, you know, people come to me and they say, well, they want to change themselves. Will therapy change them? I say, well, it's not about changing yourself. It's about accepting yourself and allowing yourself and loving yourself for who you are.
Yes.
So I guess this, you know, the books that I'm writing, I guess, were meant to be.
Well, tell us about the books.
Oh, okay.
By the way, Pete, let me mention to the listeners, I've found your website. It's really wonderful, and I've been putting some of the ideas from there right into our chat room. But it's whatiscodependency.com. It's, in fact, I put that also in the chat room. It's just a wonderful website. And you spell Darlene Lancer, D-A-R-L-E-N-E-L-A-N-C-E-R, Lancer.
Oh,
Darlene,
thank you very much, yes.
Yes.
I also have a page
on... What a wonderful resource.
Pardon me?
What a wonderful resource.
Thank you. I have a page on Facebook that I post tips on overcoming codependency and things like that every day, and when I find a good article, I post it, and that's Codependency Recovery, or you can friend me, just search for my name there. There's also links on my website, and Codependency for Dummies is available on all the online bookstores and in stores and libraries. And it's set up like a plan, a healing plan, is the way the chapters are kind of outlined. It's very comprehensive. It just covers probably everything you might want to know or need to know about codependency. And if you read it, and it's full of exercises so you can work on yourself. And if you just read through it, if you pick it up in a year from now, you'll see things, get ahas that you didn't the year before. It's that kind of book that is like an almanac. And then I have two little e-books, 10 Steps to Self-Esteem, The Ultimate Guide to Stop Self-Criticism, because I think people get so, their self-esteem gets so compromised and damaged by their internal critic. So that can be really hard to work with, and I have 10 very effective steps there. And the other, what I mentioned about assertiveness being so important, is how to speak your another ebook, How to Speak Your Mind, because assertive is set limits. and there are links on my website, and they're both available as electronic books on Barnes & Noble and Amazon and Smashwords. And people always say, I don't have a Kindle. Can you send me a copy? But you don't need a Kindle. You can just download it to your phone or your computer or something.
That's terrific.
You've come quite the journey, it sounds like, and you've come out on the other side. But so you say the steps were the key to your conscious contact with your God as you understand him.
I don't know if they were the steps. I really can't answer that. I know when I was new that my sponsor said, well, pray, and I didn't know. I had never prayed, really. I didn't know what she meant. I know what it was. I started going to some retreats. I went to spiritual retreats. That's what it was. I've forgotten. It's been so many years. And serenity retreats, and spiritual retreats, and meditation retreats. I started doing yoga, and I started meditating, and that's really how I started getting connected to a higher power. And I think I failed to mention that along the way, around the time I got divorced, I also decided to go back to school and become a psychotherapist, which is now I was returning to, you know, who I really was and what I wanted to do. And I realized at that time that it was so pointless to try to do anything to please anyone else, because, I mean, for their approval is what I mean.
Right.
Because what they want is coming from their background, their values, their personality, you know, their interests. It has, like, nothing to do with who you are. So, I mean, that's different than being kind to someone. I want to make that distinction. But trying to doing something or changing yourself to get someone else's approval is just pointless. So, and when I did return, or not return, but when I started practicing psychotherapy, I was just so overjoyed. I felt it was like taking heart vitamins. So,
I had come to this agreement. Some people don't know me, and they don't like me. Some people get to know me, then they don't like me. It's none of my business what you think of me, because you think so little of me anyway. If not in stature, surely in time. Most people aren't thinking about me unless I give them a resentment.
Right. That's for sure.
But we're thinking, what? I wonder what they're thinking about me. Well, let me give you a clue. They're not.
Yeah.
Most people are thinking about themselves. Make no mistake about it. And to waste your energy thinking what people might like you or not like you, I think it was Ricky Nelson did that. It's a garden party. You know, you
right.
have to please. You have to really please yourself. I mean, you can't. If you're not good for you, you're not good for anybody. You got to really. Once you fall in love with yourself, it's the beginning of a lifelong romance.
Well, I think, you know, one of the things about codependents is they hide who they are to be accepted by someone else, and that's because of the underlying shame. So then that creates constant anxiety, because you never know if I say the wrong thing, I should have said this, or the planning conversations, editing them afterwards, you know, and then overthinking what is the other person thinking, and how, you know, how should I react? Does he like me? Does he love me? You know, just analyzing, you know, relationships to death, and it just causes so much anxiety. And that's, I think, codependents can usually identify with that. I love this quote. It's from a poem by Mary Oliver, and I just, maybe close with that. It's, you do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of yourself love what it loves. And to me, the 12 steps are a prescription for self-love. That's how I look at them. And you might be interested that I wrote an article. It was published in a therapy magazine, and it's also on my website. I think it's called Recovery in the 12 Steps. Originally, it was Spiritual Transformation in the 12 Steps. And I go through each of the steps from a Jungian spiritual point of view to see, like, what is really happening at a psychological, psycho-spiritual level. You might like that.
Oh, I like that. I like that term, psycho-spiritual, because it really is mind, body, and spirit. There's no two ways about it. All we do in the 12 steps is to get us to a higher spiritual plane. That's it, a connection with God. I like to think action is the key word to all of this.
Absolutely.
You know, people don't realize we talk. We do a lot of talking. When we're in the service of our fellow beings, are we not in the service of our God? And we're in that service, and in that moment, are we not divorced from self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity? And in that service and in that moment, is that not when we make our conscious contact with our Creator, who lives from moment to moment, eternity to eternity, life everlasting? The magic words in AA is action and more action, for faith without works is dead. You got to take an action. You turn towards God, and then He turns towards you, but you got to take that action first. There's a lot of very ill people there, and they're wallowing in their affliction and addiction. They're not taking any action. Anyway, that's enough out of me. Do you have any last words, Darlene?
Well, I think I always talk about action when I give talks on codependency, too, because I think I have actually I put a little diagram on my Facebook page on building self-esteem. And it's first, a lot of people, when they first come to therapy or program, they don't know themselves. Someone who's been living with an addict or in a an abusive codependent relationship for a long time can end up just a shell of who they are. They really end up sacrificing who they are to stay connected to someone else, to stay in the relationship. And so they have to start first getting to know themselves. And then the next step is really taking risks. And that's where action comes in. It might be going to a meeting. It might be saying no. And then you know yourself a little differently, and it builds self-esteem. And then, excuse me, I'm losing my voice. And then you have greater self-esteem, and you can take more risks.
That's interesting. Harold, do you have anything?
Well, I'm really interested these days. Some people, especially on the addiction side of the equal sign, seem to me to have too much self-esteem. They can really anticipate what other people's reactions are, and we find this with the bullies in school. I think it's not a lack of self-esteem at all. It's too much self-esteem in the first place. I guess that's another topic for another night. I really believe in marriage. I've become a student of the Bible, and in there it says that God has invented marriage. He designed it, and God hates divorce. So I'm really in favor of, and I explain this to my clients, that I'm really in favor of trying to save the relationship. Not at all cost, but really putting effort into saving the marriage and seeing if we can achieve some healing individually. And often... In many cases, the divorce occurs after recovery has begun, maybe a year, 2 years, 5 years after recovery, because the canoe has been upset so badly. There's a delicate balance in addiction and codependency, and then when someone gets into recovery, sometimes that balance is upset and the canoe tips over. But if it's done well and people were really put in an effort, often the marriage can be saved. And I like to explain to folks that that's the position I take. I mean, as therapists, we're supposed to be objective, but no one's totally objective, so we have a responsibility to explain where we're coming from so the client can make an informed decision. And that's the position that I take. I really I think each of us, our intuition is, as Carl Jung said, it's God's way of staying anonymous. And so there's just so much richness in doing our individual work and then working on relationships. Those are the real treasures that Jesus talked about, the treasures that we take to heaven. That's our relationships. So I've enjoyed tonight's program very much. Thank you, Joseph, for having me on. Thank you, Dr. Darlene.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to say one thing in response to you, Harold, is that maybe it's just a definition, but I would really disagree. I think that bullies and narcissists don't have good self-esteem, that bullying or someone that you describe that's contemptuous, that's a defense to shame, and underneath that there's a lot of self-loathing. And narcissists are very dependent on other people's approval, and I consider them codependent. And underneath what you might think is that they're grandiose, but underneath there's when they lose their health or their money or things like that, or their looks, depending on what it is, then all of this shame and unworthiness comes out, because it's just this is all like a defense to the shame that's underneath. So I don't think that you could have too much self-esteem. I don't think that leads to arrogance or bullying, because it comes from humility. It's just self-esteem is that you accept who you are. It doesn't mean that you think you're better. If you start thinking you're better than other people, then you probably think that you're underneath, think that you're less than. If you're comparing or feel better or less than, true self-esteem is humility.
Yes, that brings us into a discussion of pride and humility. Mm-hmm. And the number one sin, I think, is pride. And so where self-esteem fits in might be hard to determine. But so we've got a terrific comment, terrific topics for a new program.
Right.
Well, we'll have to do that again sometime. I like to quote Luann Hill from The King of the Hill. Well, you know, once we're in recovery, we can stop pretending to be someone else and go back to pretending to be me. You know, you
well,
might
thank
as
you
well
so be, much, Joseph.
You're welcome. This has been fun. Thank you so much. You're very articulate and highly intelligent, and you've done a lot of work. I mean, you should be applauded for that effort. And, you know, it's like, I remember Bill W., a priest, told him one time in Cleveland after he went on and on how bad alcoholics had it, and the priest said, you know, after the meeting, he told Bill, he said, you know, he says, if you didn't go through all of this, you wouldn't have found God, and you wouldn't have had that relationship. So you alcoholics are really kind of lucky people. Sometimes the things we have to go through shape us like a potter and a piece of artwork, and we had to be molded sometimes. Sometimes we could be molded easily like some wet clay, and sometimes it's a chisel job.
Well,
I like
certainly,
to think
Yeah, if I hadn't spent, you know, over 30 years in recovery, I wouldn't have, you know, written the books I'm writing that are helping so many people, according to the, you know, the emails and the accounts I get from all over. So I just feel so grateful to have this opportunity to carry the message. So I feel very fortunate and blessed.
Thank you, Darlene. Thank you for coming on. Okay. Remember, you might as well be yourself. Everyone else has been taken. In closing,
again, Darlene Lancer, Lancer.
Yeah.
And
what is
how to find your Facebook page, and also
Facebook it's Codependency Recovery.
Codependency Recovery. Wonderful.
Or my name, Darlene Lancer.
Darlene Lancer. Well, thank you. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you again. And you're thank welcome. You, Harold. Good night.
Good night. In closing, I'd like to state that Rum Radio is in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,800 towns, cities, and villages, and we're over 300,000 hits to the website. So if you need some sponsorship information, and tonight was a little different, but I believe codependency is one of the critical areas of drug addiction and alcoholism. It brings it to a higher level, and we're supposed to grow spiritually. The big book says our sobriety is continuous of a daily spiritual condition. The thing is, what maintains itself of itself? Nothing that I have found. You're either growing spiritually or you're declining spiritually. And if you're declining spiritually, your recovery and then your sobriety can become tentative. We're expected to grow spiritually. You can't grow spiritually and be comfortable at the same time. That's where the action comes in. So remember, folks, if you got any questions on sponsorship, this is the place, rumradio.org. Thank you and good night. Good night, Harold.
Good night.
Emily.